So if we want to be blessed or live the blessed life, there are two categories we're studying. First of all, on the left side, it's what we need to be. There is a certain quality of Christian behavior that is necessary to live a joyful life. So we've been talking about being humble, verse 3, or being sorrowful about our sin, verse 4. We've talked about qualities like being gentle or hungering for righteousness or being pure or merciful. So half of the battle is we have to decide to be the right kind of people. On the other list that we've been talking about last week is we need to constantly remember what God's going to do. It is His part in all of this that ultimately makes joy possible. So we've been looking at this list down the right side, like theirs is the kingdom of heaven, or you shall be comforted, or inherit the earth, or be satisfied, or receive mercy. And we've been looking at it in a dual fulfillment kind of way. There's a sense in which everything on that list you get right now. If you are a Christian, you receive mercy. If you are a Christian, you receive comfort. You are spiritually filled. You see the presence of God. You get all those things today. And when we leave this life, we get heaven. That motivates me to want to be humble and merciful and to face persecutions because of what God does for me now and what God will ultimately do for me in the life to come. That's where happiness is found. The promises of God and the conduct of godliness. You put those two things together and get ready, because you'll live a life that Satan can't really do anything against or with. Now that brings us down near the end of the lesson. Here's what I would like for you to examine and participate in. Near the end of your first lesson, it says this idea of looking at the quote. Here we go. Please read this quote from a gospel preacher named Victor Eskew. So I hope you've taken a look at this quote. He is talking about the Beatitudes, and I'll read it for you. All of the qualities Jesus lists stand in opposition to the thinking of postmodern man. Man does not want to acknowledge his sins. He seeks happiness, not sorrow. He bows to no one except self. He believes in his own righteousness. He does not need mercy, for he is pure in his own eyes. Peace comes through tolerance. If he can live this kind of life, he will never experience the horrors of persecution. Convinced that he is good, he never seeks after God. The world of such an individual is filled with selfishness, wickedness, violence, emotional disorders, loneliness, suicide, and little, if any, purpose. All right. Question one. What are your thoughts about Brother Eskew's statement? Who wrote down some answers to what he's getting at with this powerful statement? Yes, sir.
I wrote, man thinks he's self-sufficient, but he is blind to reality. And a reference I used, Jeremiah 10:23. It is not a man who walks to direct his own steps.
Sure. I like the word he used. Man is self-sufficient. This entire list of Beatitudes is about dependency upon God. It's about being completely in and committed to doing the things that honor God and letting God return blessings to you. The self-sufficient man doesn't need all that. He doesn't need to admit that he's wrong. He doesn't need to show mercy to people. He just needs to take care of himself and he'll be happy. Well, you will hear me very often quote Dr. Phil on this. How's that working out for you? How's that working out? Just do it your way and take care of your business and don't admit to anything and take what you want and ignore everything else. How is that working for you? And that's why you have the emotional disorders and suicide and other things, because it seems like there's nowhere to turn. I tried my best and I got nothing. All right, that's a great comment. Any other comments? Yes, ma'am.
Proverbs 25:27.
Okay.
It's not good to eat much honey, nor is it glorious to seek one's own glory. A man without self-control is like a city broken through and left without walls.
All right. Good. Let's talk about this guy. Anybody ever known the guy who is not at all poor in spirit, and he never mourns over his own mistakes? It must have been the right decision because he made it, and you need to learn to live with that. And everything's about him just building the life that he wants. You ever known that guy? That guy doesn't have a lot of friends. That guy doesn't have a lot of hope. And yet, I'm thinking about Proverbs 2. My favorite, I think, proverb is Proverbs 28 and verse 13. Proverbs 28, 13. The Bible says this, "He who conceals his transgression will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes will find compassion." The person who can admit that it's not all about me, and I'm wrong, and I want to seek to do better, receives compassion from everybody. But the person who thinks that he has it all figured out receives compassion from no one. All right, good words and a good quote from the Proverbs there. Other comments on where he's getting at? Yeah.
I have written down that the biggest liar nation is telling us right now is that tolerance is peace, and that if we're not tolerant, then we're not wanting peace, and that is a struggle that we have because we should seek peace, but yet it's difficult in the country that we live in.
Our culture would say, fight for whatever you have to fight for, but not too much. Just try to stay comfortable. You know, get what you want, have what you need, and just don't get into fights that don't profit you. If it doesn't do anything for you, you don't want to be a part of it. And so tolerance is the natural outcome of that. Just let everybody do what they want to do, and I'll do what I want to do. The Beatitudes are about a blessed life that is exactly opposite that. It's giving your life over to God. It's seeking peace, verse 9. Definitely trying to seek peace, but being willing to be insulted, verse 11, and persecuted, and to suffer all kinds of things if it means standing up for what's right in Jesus. And that's a difference between the way people think today and the way the Christian behaves. Yes?
I know for years, before I became a Christian, when I played the song, I did it my way.
Okay.
And after I became a Christian, I did it God's way.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, thank the song, I did it my way.
Got a beautiful voice, but I bet if he had to do over again, he might seek somebody else's way. There were some other hands that came up. Yes.
Many times today, people who need help with material things, they'll seek others to help them. But when it comes to spiritual things, they can handle it themselves. They don't need help.
All right, don't need help. All right, blocking out everything else. And I hope you see this. And most of you here have lived plenty long enough to know that this just doesn't work. You probably used your own years trying to pursue the idea of what he's describing here. Just make sure that you're pure in your own eyes and you're doing what you want to do. And you all know that outcome. That's why you're here tonight. You're here to seek a different way, to seek God's way. And certainly we need to understand this is counterculture. I read a lot of commentators on the Beatitudes when I was studying it years ago, and this idea that the world doesn't understand this. If you want something, you take it. You don't give and show mercy and tenderness to other people. But yet, God's giving us a better way. Yes, sir.
What Mr. Eskew is talking about, he's just describing the carnal man, yeah. The natural man. And as Christians, the things that we need to be trying to do, we need to strive for are doing what comes unnatural. You know, those are the hard things to do, to love your enemies, do good to those who mistreat you and so forth. Those don't come natural, things we have to work at.
It's a great point, and that's where we're about to head into our next section about being influential. You have to be different to be influential. If everybody's the same and everybody's looking out for themselves, nobody will ever influence anybody else. You won't be a light, you'll be the exact same hue as everybody else. But this is setting us up to make a real difference. So that's it, we have to go against the impulses of the natural man. Now I'm gonna add a second question in a moment, but if you still wanna answer part of the first, you can, but let's get one more. Okay, about the pride, right? And the destruction that comes from that. Yes?
Quick comment. I've got a little bit different viewpoint. This, to me, is a fairly extreme description of what he calls postmodern modern man. Most non-Christians that I know aren't as bad as this description sounds. There are some that are that bad, but most don't have all of these attitudes.
Sure. Yeah, it is an extreme case when you start talking about wickedness, violence, emotional disorders. That's not everybody's story.
Yeah.
All right. Yes.
The root of all of this, everything we're talking about, is like Ben says, it's our carnal nature, it's self-centeredness.
Sure.
And it manifests itself in our lives depending on what our particular weakness is. But the natural instinct is to have it our way. That's the way we the carnal man looks at things. And the danger of it is, if you look at the parable Christ taught about the publican and the Pharisee,
sure.
The publican, the people we're talking about out in the world, the self-centered people out in the world, are not the real danger. It is the religious self-centered person, the self-righteous person.
Okay.
And this Pharisee, the really dangerous thing is that he was totally blind to his faults.
Okay.
He said, I thank you that I'm not like other men.
All right.
And he looked down upon this publican. So the thing that we all need to realize is that self-centeredness in our own life, if it's there, we are blind to it.
Right.
And the only way we will ever see it is through the light of the Scriptures.
Well, let's do that then. That's our next step. Go to question two. All right, let's take the light of the Scriptures and the Beatitudes that we just studied, and let's turn this thing around. How is the Christian to be different than all of that and our attitude and actions? And here's what I want you to do. In your answer, and you may have already written down an answer, but different than the postmodern man, different than the humanistic materialism around us, how does the Christian behave? But pick something from our Beatitudes list, and maybe even something that doesn't come quite so natural to you. It's easy to read a list like the Beatitudes and really pick the ones that you're pretty good at and say, yeah, that one's really important because I'm amazing at that. But it's far more productive to look at the list and think, okay, I kind of almost wish that one wasn't there. But yet, being a Christian is about looking at some of those that you know are important and saying, this is how I need to be. So whatever you have here, how is the Christian to be different in action and deeds, and how do the Beatitudes help us? Yes, sir.
Hunger and thirst, 2 Peter 3:18, but grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus, our Savior Jesus Christ. To him be glory both now and to the day of eternity.
Okay. So part of it is this seeking of God, this constant need for more of who God is and where he is and what he's revealed. All right, good. Hopefully that's something we're all trying to get really committed to. What else do we have? I want to go back to where we started. When we started with that postmodern guy, we started talking about the guy that's always right. And I don't know, if this comes easy to you, congratulations, I don't want to talk to you right now. But part of finding the peace and being different than the world is being able to say what? First two things in the Beatitudes. Say what? It was me. I am sorry for my sins. I did this. I need you to help me. I need God to help me. And I'm not afraid to admit that. That person lives a very peaceful and happy life. That person gets support. They're not hiding things. That person doesn't fear and tremble seeing God's face because he knows he's fallen at the mercy seat of God. This person is happy in a way that the world wouldn't think. The world would think you just have to keep that face on and make sure that everybody thinks you're great. Those are the people who hide things and suffer. All right, so there's something that hits me as something I want to do better. What else do you get for number two? How are we to be different?
1 Timothy 5:1-2. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands. Do not share the sins of others.
Okay.
Keep yourself pure.
Yeah, keep yourself pure. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. All right. Anybody else? Yes. Okay.
I was thinking about that one too, because like our minds should be so renewed that we don't see innuendos in every little thing throughout society, you know, and just be so pure that like it just passes right over us instead of us like making the connection that's supposed to be there.
Yeah, being pure, just sort of like a pure outlook and not always sort of drawn to things that are immoral. That's good. All right, anybody else on this? Christian to be different? Yes.
The main statement that I got from Brother Askew's statement was that this postmodern man is convinced that he is good. And that is so descriptive of our world that even people that we know in the world that profess to be Christians, they are convinced that they are good. And we all struggle with that, I think, at some point, because we all want to be good. We all try to convince ourselves that we're good. And we do that because we don't want anybody to persecute us, to say things against us because of our actions, because we're different. And so I'm okay, you're okay, let's not fight about it.
Yeah.
And so I kept going back to verses 11 and 12 and thinking about the world we live in and how little we're persecuted and how little we try, or how much we try to avoid being persecuted because we convince ourselves that we're okay.
Yeah, that's good. No, actually, I've been thinking a lot about that too. Sunday morning's lesson, Lord wills, we're going to talk about this idea of persecution today as it sort of relates to first century, but it's different, but in a lot of ways it's very, very similar. And having an attitude that not only is unsurprised by it, but really is looking for it a little bit. I think it's a real page turner in your life when you begin to consider insults and people who speak poorly against you and reject you as an indication of your faithfulness to God. If I'm experiencing things like that, I must be doing something right. The postmodern guy, you know, he's just looking for, just keep it cool and not worry about confrontation. And so ultimately, that's why we live in a religion where acceptance is the only way, so that we don't have to fight about things. All right, last question here. What about God's promises keep us blessed or happy, or however you want to describe the term, even while we're going through some really, really difficult things? Maybe you're dealing with your own mistakes. Maybe other people are treating you poorly. Maybe you're trying to make peace when peace is not what other people want. How does God's promises keep you feeling blessed even when it's tough? I need you to be looking at that right side for this. What'd you put for that?
The reward of heaven is worth more than all the persecution we could suffer in this life.
I don't know if it can be put any better than that. The reward of heaven is worth whatever we lose. And it's hard to think like that. I live right here and today. And it's easy to only see right here and today. But, you know, every Christian and every generation before us has died. None of them are still living. They're all gone. They've gone somewhere, and that's where they've been since. And that's where, in some sense, they'll be forever. And when we get that bigger picture, that heaven picture, that changes things. All right? What else? Give me even some more immediate things. I mean, that's the best answer. I'm going through tough things. I'm really trying to fight for my faith. I'm making the unnatural decision to make peace here when I want to rub a knot on your head. But I do it. And I do it with the right attitude because of something God has promised me. Let's go back here.
I said on that one that we have to remember that the true blessings will be delayed. We live in a culture now where it's instant gratification. And our culture now is harder for us because it is that instant gratification. That there's no layaways even in our culture hardly anymore. So we don't even understand storing something up and being able to purchase it at a later time after we've been making payments on it, you know, in our culture now. So we have to remember that blessings are delayed.
That's good. Good point. Longer view. I like that. Let's go over here first.
The analogy Jesus uses at the end of the Sermon on the Mount is of a storm and of a rock versus the sand. One of the things you can see here is consistency. God isn't lying, he's telling the truth. This is a rock you can stand on when life gets difficult.
Okay, great, good. And that's kind of what I'm specifically asking for. What is it about his promises that become that rock for you that you can stand on? Up here, yes?
He gives us mercy.
He does, he gives us mercy. When do you get that? Right now and later. You get mercy today and tomorrow and forever. That's a good one. Yes, ma'am.
When you're going through a trial and you've done something that you know is glorifying God,
yeah,
it brings a peace that passes all understanding.
Sure does.
So you get that peace now, you know that you've got God. When you go through that, you come out.
It's good, yeah. The satisfaction that comes from that. There was something over, I'll head back over here in a second, back here.
One of the things about God's promises is when you're going through a trial, you're looking for consistency, but God is truthful. The things that he tells us, that's going to happen.
Okay. Yeah. You will be sons of God. You are God's children. You will always be God's children. And don't overlook this beautiful little phrase. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I don't believe that's talking about heaven's gates. That's not the way Matthew used the term. That's talking about what I am a part of right this second. I am under the protection of the rule of the king. It just doesn't get any better or more consistent or reliable than that. Yours is entrance into that kingdom. Yes?
Today, right now, we have to realize that our primary purpose is to serve God. And whether it's self-confidence or our purpose or whatever, we can say affirmations to ourselves all day. I'm a precious, loving child of God. When we're actually out there getting the work done, it becomes something different. It becomes real. It becomes power in our lives that we can use today. And that makes all the difference in the world. The verse I had for that was Hebrews 14:16 says, "Let us with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find help in time of need."
We're going to take another comment. I saw another hand go up, but that's our bridge to the next point. We're going to turn the page now and head to lesson two. We're seeking peace in God. We believe in it. Now it's time to make a difference. The true test of understanding the Beatitudes, verses 1 through 12, is making a difference, verses 13 through 16. So that's what we'll look at next. I think I saw one more hand go up over here. You guys are ready to? Yes, go ahead.
Well, it was sort of me, but Jenny said what I was getting at, that when we're going through trials and we know that the ultimate goal is heaven, you know, and that's why we should ultimately continue. But what's going on in our lives right now, when you literally turn those problems over to God and you just let go and say, I can't do this myself. And that's when the comfort comes, and that's when you're able to sleep again and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, but you know, when that list that says, you know, those who mourn will be comforted, and if you hunger and thirst for righteousness, you're going to be satisfied. And those are right now.
They are. I'll surround you with 150 people who love you and who love me. It's just. What the kingdom is today is so much more powerful than I think people recognize or realize. I'm not just drudging through, barely making it, hoping I get to see some pearly gates one day and it's all worth it. I'm here with you guys tonight. Can I just tell you, it's already worth it. Because of this family, it's already worth it. Because of what we can be for each other, this was already the right decision. And then will come, of course, the great blessings that follow. Let's take a look at lesson two. Matthew chapter 5. So our first section is be happy. Now we'll have a lesson or two on being influential. You are very, very familiar with this. So I'll read the text and we'll just jump right in. Verse 13 says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Okay, this section is an important follow-up to the introduction. This is a paragraph right there on your page. Our first section spoke about our attitude, our hopes, and the faith that drives us to be content and happy. But discipleship is not limited to inward renovation and a personal spirit. I mean, you need to feel good. That's great. But that's not all this is about. We are also his workmanship, Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10, created in Christ, not just to feel good, but for good works. So, God requires his people to be influential, to speak and act and live in a way that preserves what is right in our world and stands as a beacon of light to lead wayward folks to the light that is Jesus. That's it. We want to influence this world and lead people to Jesus. Everybody wants to do that, but not everybody's doing that. This study is about really understanding how to engage that. So salt of the earth is where we begin. That's, of course, found there in verse 13. This illustration draws our attention to the direct effect, changing effect even, we can have on the world around us. And by world, we mean sort of three circles, our closest people, and then sort of the people that we're acquaintances with, and then even out there on those outer fringes, those folks that you try to avoid typically. All of them can be affected. So first question, and look, you've heard 912 sermons on this. I've preached 911. So you're just one sermon more educated than me. So we're pretty familiar with salt and light. But let's throw out a couple of ideas of what it means to you anyway. Firstly, what are the good elements of salt that Jesus is referring to here? When he says, be the salt of the earth, what's he talking about? Say again. The best on earth. All right. Salt is the best. The best on earth. All right. Different in that way. Good. Yes.
In medieval times, salt was considered very, very precious.
Okay.
And they made elaborate, beautiful holders for their salt. And they would place it in front of the most important person at the table. So salt of the earth means that we are really, really important, influential, necessary kind of folks.
Okay, good. So we're influential. So we're trying to be the best we can be and be different, trying to be influential and precious. Anybody remember, have you ever studied sort of how salt was used? I mean, I know how we use salt today. I'm not really allowed to comment on that. I don't use salt in my house. The cooking's just that good. But when you go to a restaurant and they put out that potato and it's a little dry, put that salt on there. What does the salt do to the potato? If there's anything, isn't salt amazing? If there's anything good in that potato anywhere, it pulls it out and magnifies it by 10. Have you noticed that? You're eating a good steak and you're tasting that good part, you put a little salt on it, boom. I mean, it magnifies the best. So that's sort of how we use it today, and I think that's a usable analogy here as far as any situation you're in. Anything that's going on, if there's anything redeemable about it, you should be the person who draws that redeemable thing out. You should be the person who says, look, this looks like the worst situation ever, and it's going to come to blows, but you know, I've been thinking about this, and I think there actually might be a way we can work this out. You're pulling that out. Now, that's sort of how we would use it, but does anybody remember, not that you're 2,000 years old, but how it would have been used in first century times? Yes, sir?
Preserves from corruption.
Okay, preserves from corruption. Why was that so necessary in the first century? Oh, go ahead, what do you have?
It also cleans wounds, although it hurts a lot, just like truth.
That's good. I don't preach on that. It hurts when you put it on your wound, but it cleans it. All right, this is going to hurt a little bit. Yes?
The lack of refrigeration in the early, or in the first century, or even times before that, the lack of refrigeration caused salt to be needed to purify or to preserve meat, whatever. That we take for granted now because we need to freeze it or just refrigerate it,
yeah.
Make it last for several days. But the good elements that this purification or preservation or morality, civil obedience, caring for each other and our neighbors,
okay.
And just being God-fearing people.
All right. That's what he's talking about. So he did help us understand the idea. You know, back then they didn't have freezers to preserve things, refrigerators. So they would dig these holes in the ground and it would be cooler there and the meat would last longer, but it still wouldn't last a really long time. But if they would coat that thing with salt, salt would preserve it. Salt is a preservative and an enhancer of flavor. Those are sort of the two ideas. But I'm convinced really what Jesus is driving at is the idea that somebody has to preserve what's good around here. If there's nobody here to stand up for what's good and stay holding on to what is holy, then we're going to lose the whole thing. And I don't think it's just coincidence that this immediately follows the two verses that say, be ready and be willing to be insulted and persecuted and rejoice in it even when you're going through the kinds of things that the prophets did, because somebody's got to keep this thing going. If everybody backs up like postmodern man and says, I don't fight about that, you know, whatever, White House, colored flag, whatever, just, I'm just going to do my thing. Guess what happens to morals? Same thing that happens to meat. If you leave it out, it's rotten. Who can keep what's right going? It's going to take a special kind of people. I think I like your analogy about salt hurting a little bit. It's going to take a special kind of people who are willing to preserve something when nobody else seems to want to preserve it. And that's sort of the idea here about facing insults and persecutions. Yes, sir.
In this chain reference under salt, it says the church lacks salt to save by contact.
Say that again.
It says the church lacks salt.
All right, say we're going to have to get nitty gritty. We're actually going to have to make contact and do something. Now, there are a couple of things that jump out at me about this verse. Did you notice, we talk about negative preaching sometimes. Everybody knows what negative preaching is, right? Like, don't do this, and if you do this. Did you see verse 13? It starts with, it doesn't say you should be or be. It says, you are the salt of the earth. And then what does the rest of the verse teach? Like, if you don't do this, you're out. If you can't do this thing for me, you can't be here. This is really tough language. It's the kind of stuff that Jesus only could say. He said, look, if you've lost the ability to preserve integrity, what good is salt that can't do that? It has no value. You just throw that stuff out. Otherwise, you might accidentally use it, think it makes a difference, and it won't. So Jesus is really challenging us here to preserve. And in a moment, we're going to talk about some specific areas where we can do this. There was a comment over here, and then I'll get to Josh. Yeah, go ahead.
I looked up like all the different elements of salt, and one of the things I haven't heard is that it melts ice. We use it when it's cold outside. The salt doesn't kind of melt ice. So we may be needed to cut through the cold parts.
Okay, all right. That's interesting.
You know, and help heal the wounds, like what she was saying, you know, heal the wounds. And I mean, our salt purposes may be different with different people. Like, it may be this person we may be needed to help heal the wound, and this person we may be needed to cut through the...
But make a difference. Do something. Be bold. 3-point sermon. Salt heals wounds. Salt melts ice. Salt shrinks slugs. 3 points. The spiritual application of the third one I have to work on, but somehow there's something there I can use. Josh, go ahead.
Salt, like salt, we're expected to have an impact.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the potato thing. I don't want to offend anybody, but if I eat just a plain potato, I just want to gag.
Yeah.
But if I take the salt and I shake it on there and I take a bite and it still tastes like the plain potato, I'm going to take the salt and throw it out.
Yeah.
And I think Jesus is describing that same thing. If we don't have an impact, then we're just as worthless.
That's exactly what we're getting at. And listen, this is timing perfectly with our personal evangelism Sunday morning study. It only works if you're willing to rub a little. If you're willing to make a difference and you recognize that the contentment you're going to feel is by doing what's right, not just because people respond well. They may not respond well. This is not based on their reaction. This is based on Jesus charging me to preserve something in this town. Something. And to make that difference and to make things better. And, you know, it's a real challenge that goes hand in hand. Let's go back here first. Was it Paul?
If you eat salt that has been thoroughly filtered, it looks a lot whiter, but it's not nutritious. Real salt has a little black in it, has a little pink in it, has some actual flaws, but it's a lot more nutritious.
It's like that was too deep for me. All right, I got one better. Salt makes you thirsty, and then you go baptize somebody. Yes, sir.
You've heard the saying that you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Okay.
Give him a little salt.
That's what I was thinking, right? Makes him thirsty. Okay, let's get practical. And if you still want to comment, we'll start with Mr. James in a minute. But after his comment, okay, Great, we get it. We've heard all those sermons. Every comment tonight was good. Some of them were interesting. All good, though. What does it really mean? How are you really going to be salt, not in this earth, in Smith County, in your life? All right, Mr. James.
Well, I'm not quite 1,000 years old or 2,000. Uh-huh. Probably older than most people in here. But I've lived in a time when meat was preserved for salt.
Oh, yeah. All right. So it's not a foreign concept. Okay. All right, let's get practical. What do you have, Mr. Joe?
Well, one thing, like Sunday's lesson, it kept coming to my mind that before we go out and pack these cards out, we got to first do this. We got to get the salt.
Okay.
We got to live it. We can't just go hand out cards and live the world. We got to live the word before we can pack those cards out and show them to come be with me.
And great point.
It won't work.
All right. That's conversation. That's attitude. That's all of it. The card is just supposed to be an extension of who you already are. It's good. Yes?
In the Middle Eastern countries, salt, when it's mined, is not pure. It's very, has a lot of earthly matter and things that are inside of it. They have to take that part out. If we let too many things of the world come into us, we will not be pure enough to be able to shine anywhere.
All right. We want to make a difference. We want to push through that. So question two here. Secondly, what is your spiritual application of what he just said? Yes?
The value of salt, especially in that day, it was something that worldwide could be used in exchange for anything. And so we think about salt as something that having a value, and now we have an unlimited amount of salt.
Okay.
And we have this value, we need to use it. And we're going to be able to have that salt, and we want to tell people about the value of the salt that we have. I think there's times we don't understand the value of the salt, but we need to keep the salt seasoned. If we don't, then the value's gone. If we're not actively using that salt, then it's good for nothing. So if we're continually reflecting upon the value of the salt that's there and the value of what we can do with the salt, there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah.
But we also have to make sure that the salt's being used in the right way. I don't remember who it was that wrote the article, but it talked about the salty ham and not having hammy salt.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's about the influence that we have and the spiritual implication of that. And the influence, from our standpoint, we want to be able to use our salt in the way that we're going to make others salty.
Sure. Good point. And maybe what you do, you get up in the morning and you think, how do I get this into somebody's life today? It has to get practical at some point. At some point, all those great comments has to live in you somehow. How do I get this? Maybe we what were you guys say at the park? Just reading a half an hour before Bible class, hoping somebody shows up. Somehow trying to make that move and make that difference. I hope that, anybody handed out any cards yet this week? All right, good. Are you afraid to raise your hand because it's like, look at me, I handed out cards? No, you shouldn't be, all right? We're looking for 100% participation in telling people who we are and where we go to church and how great it is. And we're starting with 3 cards, and we're going to grow from there. But there's a really great indicator opportunity. Let's get another comment or two. I was thinking, by the way, of the 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11, where it says, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against your soul. And the reason I bring that up is don't forget that being a difference for right might mean not doing wrong things. And that's kind of where Joe was going. Probably, if I'm going to be an influence for good, shouldn't be that person who's lecturing you on this, but over there doing that. So one of the first things I want to do is keep my behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Something about what you're doing has got people inquisitive. They want to know more about what's going on with you and how you're living. Here's what I'd like for you to do. If you haven't filled in the answer there, go ahead and do that for next week. Finish out lesson 2. Go ahead and get started into lesson 3 a little bit. Kyle Wright will be teaching the class, and he's going to get us through lesson 2 and maybe start lesson 3. So we'll pick that up next week. Thank you for your attention.